Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And our icebreaker question today is about a tweet someone asked. He works in IT, and he uploaded a security alert image that says, "You're opening an application Microsoft Auto Update for the first time. Are you sure you want to open the application?" And then the gentleman asks how a normal user is supposed to make an informed decision about the security alert. And I want to hear your remarks.
This is Forrest, and I actually didn't think that was that bad of a window. I mean, I think we've seen some of the newer Windows messages that are like something went wrong or something like that. Those are bad. And I would say at the other end of the spectrum, like the 90s blue screens were also bad on the other side. That seems like right in the middle. And I feel pretty okay with that error message, or that warning, rather.
Hi, this is Killian. The screenshot Cindy's talking about is from a Mac, I believe, and it almost goes back to like the Windows kind of mentality is, if we get the user to agree to it, we've indemnified ourselves against the liability to a certain extent. Like, it's their fault or their problem if they clicked on the wrong thing and didn't know any better. Now, I'm always a big proponent of giving the users as much information to make it an informed decision as possible, but this is not a super great alert in terms of what it is saying. But I don't know if there's a great or better way to do this. A lot of times when these things happen, unless it's kind of very direct, I just clicked on this executable and it popped up, the user might not be able to connect those two dots. So I don't know if there's a great way to do this, but kind of just dumping the responsibility on them, it's not great either for security, because my guess is they don't care. They just want to get whatever they're doing done. So they're going to click OK regardless of what it says.
This is Matt. We have users that they don't really know what they're looking at, but I'd say that there is an improvement to be made here. And something that I encounter with browsers often and on web pages when you're trying to trust certificates, it often states the publisher. And so I think if really got behind developers signing their code and really got behind these alert messages displaying those signatures and that they've been validated, I think that would go a long way. I think if you saw like a green checkbox here and said something like signed by Microsoft, you know, would build that trust in users. Now, obviously, you know, certificates can be forged, but I think that would be a step in the right direction.
Thanks, guys. And if you're a regular listener and you enjoy our show, if you can rate and review our podcast on iTunes, we'll send you a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. To learn more, please visit veronis.com/review. For today's show, I want to talk about the tension between users and developers, and I want to extend that conversation to the new product Amazon created, where you can give their delivery specialist access to your house, where they can just go in and drop off the item you purchased. And some have criticized that technology has been reduced to, I'm a 25-year-old person and I still want my mother to do these things for me. And we're also creating products and services just because we can and not because it solves a real issue. And the Washington Post article argued that there's more to life than convenience, and I want to hear your opinions.
I don't know about anybody else, but this looked to me like just another like IoT device to get hacked. Isn't this something that, it's internet connected and it's a lock for your door? Wasn't there an issue with that one deadbolt company a couple years ago where there was like some bad update that went out and doors were either locked or unlocked, I forget, for a couple days while it was like waiting for a rollout? Am I remembering that correctly?
I'm not too familiar, Forrest, with that. I'm sure I could envision it happening, especially with those Nest doors. I had a Nest system with like even the thermostat, and I always wondered about whether or not that was vulnerable. I think that this, and as the article calls it out, not in touch with the user base, I think Amazon couldn't be further from their customers in this case. The people who I see that actually deliver packages, I don't want in my home. And it's not because they don't look like good people. It's just because they are a delivery person. What is their incentive to not peruse through my home or, you know, to violate my privacy and not just drop off that package? Now, I would feel like by giving them access now, I think I need to put a camera on the inside door instead of just on the outside door, because I need to make sure that when they're in my home, the only thing they're doing is dropping off a package. And I think this idea that just to get the package onto the other side of the door is likely just to save Amazon on the insurance side. They probably have a lot of packages get stolen. And they probably have to replace a lot of items for a lot of people.
I just can't see a situation where I'd want to let a stranger into my house kind of unrestricted like that. And it also leads down, as Matt mentioned, is to a more broad security state. If you do have the people kind of roaming in and out of your house like this, the instinct is going to be to put a camera inside. And then you've kind of self-acquiesced to being monitored potentially. As we've seen with the IoT devices, and webcams in particular, they can be very insecure, kind of opening you up to the world to kind of watch what you're up to. And on the other side, from the Amazon delivery person perspective, walking into a stranger's house like that, kind of sight unseen, could be a dangerous proposition as well, too. There's always a certain amount of risk human interactions, but you don't necessarily want to just kind of turn up in somebody's house. You don't know what could happen.
Can you put your empathy hat on and think about if you're a developer and you've been tasked to create this new technology, innovation, possibility, what would go through your mind? How would you bring it up to your manager and to talk about this?
This would be really tough. I feel like if I was in the position where someone came in and said, you know, do this thing, create this device, and I was like morally against it, like I really felt like it would violate some part of my being, that would leave me feeling really conflicted. And I think that conversation would probably go like, you know, I'm happy to build this product and I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. But I really feel like now I would try to say it in a way that wasn't directly attacking the thought of the idea. But I would say, I don't think it's going to be successful. And these are the reasons why. I think too many customers are going to object to allowing someone they don't know into their home. Too many customers are going to object to Amazon having the ability to come and go from their home. And I would try to really focus on that and even make recommendations for maybe doing some surveys or doing a limited pilot before really releasing this and seeing what the feedback was.
No, I think you're entirely right, Matt. And I face situations like this in, you know, in my life too. And hopefully, at least in my case, I've always had people that I worked for or worked with that I had good relationship with. And I felt comfortable being able to be honest about it. Granted, you know, there's a certain degree of tact that you have to have when you bring this up, but you have to have that relationship, I guess, to be able to speak up. And then that goes into a lot of culture, and been lucky, at least in my career so far, to work at places that have a culture where they're open to hearing ideas, even if they're a little bit different or maybe challenge kind of the thought process. But that's all you can do. I mean, you have to be able to have the internal courage as well, too, to bring that up and say, hey, listen, this is, have you ever thought about this? Or have we thought about this possibility? And to a certain extent, you have to accept if you get overruled. It stinks and, you know, you're going to have to live with that or perhaps ask to be on a different project. But these moral questions don't have easy answers, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I would also add that I personally would probably think that a lot of these kind of ethical questions, or maybe not ethical, but questions of, you know, is it worth doing this if we foresee there being ethical questions later that reduce the marketability of it? I mean, I would hope that those are largely addressed kind of before the rubber is meant to meet the road, you know, and it's being handed to developers to really get started on. I would hope that a lot of those are addressed. But, you know, if it gets to that point, then I certainly agree with kind of where you guys are coming from.
One thing that all four of us might not think about are what are the use cases where this product really hits it out of the park? And is that enough of a customer base to make it successful? Because I could think of, like, you know, my grandmother. I mean, this would be great. I mean, she wouldn't have to get up to get the door. The person would come in and drop it off. You know, or I could think about, what if it's really heavy? You know, what if it's like food delivered for my pets and it comes in a 40-pound bag? Well, if that person got that 40-pound bag all the way inside my door, I might not need to move it. So I think that there's definitely some use cases on why this would be good. And that's probably, you know, what everyone focused on as they were developing it.
That's true. I'd be still concerned about someone. Maybe there's accessibility, you know, concerns that lead to someone to be thinking about something like this. I mean, that sounds great, but I mean, I would still think that somebody with accessibility concerns probably still have the same potential security concerns. That's not really an answer. That's really just another layer to the question.
No, yeah, and it just means they'd have to accept that risk. You know, they'd have to think about it and say, do the benefits outweigh that cost?
And then kind of another thing that, Matt, you just made me think of too is liability. Let's say they are, you know, hey, it's not a security risk, that's fine, but what if they're bringing in that 40-pound of bag of dog food or whatever, and they trip and they fall?
Right.
Who's responsible for that lawsuit? A whole other can of worms.
So to extend our conversation on what developers are creating, there's a neural network that can render photographs of people's faces into a person that doesn't yet exist. And it'd be a really great way to maybe figure out what your future offspring might look like. But first thing that came to my mind was it can be the face of a human robot. And then I was also thinking that, you know, by giving a robot a face, we're in some ways humanizing them. And what are your thoughts on this nervous energy that everybody's talking about with, oh my God, these robots are taking over the world.
The fact that these AIs can create, you know, photorealistic people that don't exist based on training, that scares the crap out of me, to be honest. I think for most of our lives, and everybody can agree that seeing is believing. You know, you see something. So much of our life is based on photo evidence, if you will. I saw this happening, or there's a picture of this, so it must be true. And I think the fact that we're getting to the point where we start having to doubt what we see, or the photoshopping, or the can create these pictures that maybe don't exist or are different, starts to cast that in a lot of doubt. So there's a lot of things that we have to think about. Maybe I talk to lawyers too much, but my mind goes to, you know, entering that in evidence. Hey, this person, you know, robbed me, or hey, this person supposedly dropped off my Amazon package. Is it the person that the camera said it was? Or has this been tampered with or altered? I think it's becoming much more difficult to believe some of this digital evidence, and that's kind of the bedrock of a lot of our trust in society.
I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords. I'm all ready for this. And the same thing with these new technologies. You know, we are really, every time something like this happens, we're on the brink of another discovery, or we're on the brink of another medical advancement. What if these facial images help with facial reconstructive surgery, or what if they help identify aging issues? I think that it's all for the better, even if it's just a creative expression that, hey, look, we can take a face and we can morph it into something that doesn't yet exist or something that might exist someday. I think that's great. I think that's the advancement of mankind at its best, and creativity at its best.
I'm interested to kind of maybe dig into that a little bit, because you said in the kind of the previous point, you know, what are the use cases? And that's where my mind goes to. You know, what are the use cases for this? I feel like a lot of technology is developed in a bubble. You know, we can do this, so we're going to, but what for? And that's one of the things that I didn't see in this article. Why are they developing this? The article read to me like it was, hey, this is cool, and we can do this, but you know, your use cases there are kind of the bounds of the parameters, like what are we going towards? You know, what do we want to see out of this? And I think without those kind of use cases of parameters, that's what scares me. Technology unbridled for, you know, for a purpose.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of I keep making references to things that people may or may not understand, but or remember, but wasn't there something about like fake pop singer that was like, it was like a movie about like an artificially generated like pop singer made all this money and it didn't have any like concerns about like, you know, as a person being overworked or compensated for fairly or anything like that. I mean, I wonder if that's an application. Actually, one thing actually that pops out to me is that I wonder if there's like more facial recognition technology. And I wonder, you know, this coming out at the same time, maybe not the exact same time, but I wonder if there's like a sort of a like a push and pull to like new technology where, you know, some of it is used for security and some of it can be used to beat that security. I wonder if there's some application there. Again, more questions than answers, but they do kind of pop into my head.
Let's go back to reality now and talk about things that are happening soonish, where Firefox users, at some point, they'll get to be more engaged when it comes to their privacy, and they'll make it so that they first get the permission from users before companies who add fingerprints on websites and extract data about you and sell your information. And can you guys first explain what fingerprints are and then comment on your impressions of this new feature?
They take a lot of image. So based on like an embedded tag within the web page, they're able to collect a lot of information, your browser version, get some information about your OS and your patch level, and a number of other different things. And this information is, in combination, can be unique enough to identify your computer versus everybody else's. So they gather enough and it's slightly different enough that it's a fairly high accuracy way to pinpoint that this is Killian's computer versus Cindy's versus Matt's versus Forrest. And they're using that for additional tracking, as opposed to a cookie, which is something stored on your machine, that I think is pretty, everybody, I think, for the most part, at least has a general idea of what the cookies are for tracking, or who are at least listening to this podcast. So this is kind of a new and different way to do it.
Yeah, Firefox is taking a stand on the user side, and I think that's why people use Firefox and people browse with Firefox. When you talk about internet browsers, major players, Chrome, Firefox, Internet Explorer, /Edge, and I think I don't want to think of which ones care about my privacy. I really only think of Firefox and all the add-ons that they support, whether it's for blocking advertisements or not allowing scripts to run, the different ways that they've handled Java security over the years. So like, for instance, Firefox was the first to really push forward with a per site Java list and Java exception list, where if you wanted Java to run on a web page, you had to grant it permission. I think this is just another step forward, really giving the control to the users. But I think it's at the cost of users having to be a bit savvy. You know, this conversation started with a tweet about a security update for Microsoft Auto Updater. Now we're going to ask about a little piece of tracking information. You know, are they going to do that on a per web page basis? Is that going to be a global setting? How are they going to prompt users to make that decision? You know, I think that's really kind of this turns into.
After reading the article, I mean, there's the obvious kind of security risks, but I mean, the truth of the matter is, like, you know, it says, oh, do you want to use, you know, Tor browser or was it the nightly builds of Firefox? People's functionality is benefited by the ability to have cookies or this kind of fingerprinting or something like that, you know, and potentially in some cases, well, maybe not as much the fingerprinting, but places where, you know, you're able to kind of track a user can be beneficial on some sites for usability. So it is one of those interesting things where, you know, you don't necessarily want to just completely disable it and never have that technology work again, you know, any kind of tracking technology.
No, Forrest, you beat me to it. Since Mike isn't with us today, I was going to play devil's advocate and say, you know, what's the harm? What's the harm in letting them track all this information about us? It could really benefit us by giving us, you know, suggestions about website visits or items that we might like based on our previous browsing habits or restaurants or shops nearby based on the fact that we were looking at a web page on our mobile device. So for Mike, when he listens to this, I got your back, buddy. That's one thing that we have to balance out is that, again, I wish security was absolute, but there's a lot of gray area we have to play in between.
So earlier this week, I went to the O'Reilly Security Conference and I heard Runa Sandvik speak. She is the director of InfoSec at the New York Times. And she shared a really interesting story about how years and years ago, Yahoo had three different security departments. There was the primary InfoSec department, a dedicated one where they were subject matter experts on security, and they're still on the InfoSec team, but they worked with different teams to do something securely. And the third one is it's a local team. They're still considered security. They're not on the InfoSec team, but they're responsible for securing all the data and the devices for another team. And it made me wonder, somewhere in between all the creating, all the innovating, organizations forgot about security and tossed the local and dedicated departments. And now we're doing all sorts of things. We're blaming users and say that they're the weakest link and users work around security. But, you know, they're just getting their work done, thinking the best of everyone that they want to do things securely. But sometimes we security people make it a roadblock for them. Then there are more data breaches that are happening. And then my cynical side is, well, you know, maybe that's what cyber insurance is for. Even though I also learned at the conference that phishing isn't included insurance. So in between all the shifting of budgets and organizational changes, and also organizations are seen as a cost center and not taken seriously, but organizations can't function without IT.
You know, when you mentioned that traditional Yahoo model, I kind of thought of big enterprise InfoSec, where you might have like an enterprise team of security analysts and engineers where they really direct the policy for an organization. Like if you thought of a big bank or, you know, another large like Fortune 100 company, and then you might have integrated teams that go into the different subject matter areas like application security or database security, and they might be embedded right with the developers and the IT admins. And then you might have like a information security officer at a local site, kind of how they're all working together. And that's really how you thought about, you know, really big, broad scale, robust security shops. And now, you know, what do I see, you know, as a security architect at Varonis is even more where it's just the kind of security is being inherited by someone. So a person who might have been an application developer for four is now a security engineer. And I think what you were asking is, you know, what's the right balance? And I think that the right balance is not blaming the users, but really saying that they're a part of the equation. So security is actually everyone's responsibility. Just like, you know, signing into your computer, or if you have to do timesheets, everyone has to do timesheets or expense reports. I mean, there are just things that are inherent part of any job. And I think that security has to be one of those things. And that's really where we move away from blaming the users. And in terms of security, you know, being a roadblock, I think that that's probably the toughest question of all of them. You know, you always have to balance security and usability and functionality. And I think everyone struggles with finding, you know, how much security is enough security. And I think that's really where you kind of have to look at, you know, what your highest priority risks are and what it takes to treat them. And then really look also at, you know, what you're experiencing. Are you under threat of a lot of data breaches? Do you have any visibility into that? Or are you at a place where you really don't even know what's going on? And maybe the first step is to expand on it.
In kind of my experience, what I found is typically, at least from what I've seen, security tends to be much more of a roadblock when it's an afterthought, as opposed to being built into the process. Because when it's built in, you can take into account the user experience and a lot of other feedback when designing a smooth system. When it's, you know, when it's after the fact or when it's bolt on, that's when it's like throwing six more locks on your front door. I see that a lot, and is not very beneficial just to go around blaming the users for it. Now, to a certain extent, it's true. Users are not typically security people, but anymore, I think it's in the news so much that I think people are warming up to the idea. But that's not their focus. That's not what they wake up and think about like some of us do every day. They want to do the thing that they're supposed to do or they have to do, and that's it. The onus is on us as security people and evangelists of security to a certain extent to help organizations realize that it's better for everybody if we could start to consider security earlier in the process and bake it in.
You know, any kind of department within an organization that is not necessarily revenue generating, I mean, this has been sort of a mental obstacle, I guess, for like, you know, organizations for generations. You know, I mean, what was it like when people started actually developing like, you know, human resources departments as just sort of a standard that an organization needs to have? And when did they get over potentially the idea that it's a cost center as opposed to a profit enabler or a protection from liability? So, I mean, I would hope, and you know, we do definitely see it today, you know, more and more, but I would hope that the same sort of mental approaches towards, you know, understanding the value of any other sort of, I guess you might call it support department or logistics, or that's not correct, but, you know, something that's not necessarily revenue generating. I would hope that starts to apply more and more to information security. Thankfully, I think it does, but.
Thanks to Killian Englert, Forrest Temple, Matt Redilak, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again soon. Bye.
Thanks everyone.
Bye, everyone.